It's Morning Edition on 90.1 WABE. Great to have you with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. It's Friday. It's breakfast time, political breakfast time. Theron Johnson and Brian Robinson are back with us. Theron is a former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. He is a Democratic strategist. Brian is a Republican strategist and former Deputy Chief of Staff and Communications Director for Georgia Governor Nathan Deal. Welcome. Good to have you guys.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dennis.
As the General Assembly lurches toward adjournment, the key deadline of crossover day took place, but that doesn't mean that every bill that didn't make it out of at least one chamber is actually dead. It's only mostly dead, as they said in The Princess Bride. But one bill that is getting a great deal of attention, Brian, is the governor's education plan B, if you will, intervention in school districts without taking them over this time. But the big question is, where's the money going to come from for this? And the governor's been a little bit coy on this one.
Well, it's going to have to come directly out of the education budget. You look, 50%, maybe 51, 52% of the state budget goes to education. There should be enough there to make sure this happens. And I know legislators have looked a lot at administrative costs of schools. Mm-hmm. And
but
the money,
districts are saying, hey, look, the funding's been cut back ever since Sonny Perdue came into office.
Cut back
in real terms. Obviously, Governor Deal restored some of the cuts.
He's restored almost all. And that is an arbitrary formula that doesn't really mean anything. This is the real world scenario. Every year that Governor Deal has been in office, we have had a real dollar increase in money going to K-12 education.
But you mentioned the formula, and the governor and the legislators decided that instead of revising that formula, which was the original plan, they would do this for the struggling schools instead. So they could have tinkered with that formula.
And I think that they should have. I think that this is something the governor campaigned on in 2014. He was right then, and he didn't stop being right as time went on. This is something that he's promised to do. The plan that he has put forward in the past or discussed, in at least in broad terms, is what the state needs. We have a formula that is more than 30 years old, and it gives your political opponents this bludgeon to hit you with over and over again, saying that you've cut spending when every year in real dollars you are increasing spending. There should be enough money in there in our budget to go after the problems and failing schools, invest more heavily in those, and make sure that those kids have a bright future.
You know, words matter, and I cannot believe that here we are in another year doing a legislative session, and we still hear Republicans use terms that were very unpopular and the reason why voters voted against OSD the first time.
When I hear OSD is Opportunity School District.
Yeah, when I hear my good friend Brian Robinson come on this show again on Friday morning and still using the term failing, I just think that Republicans have not learned their lesson. Let's also point out that the governor right now is in an ongoing feud with his state school superintendent. The two of them can't get on the same page of how they want to educate our kids in this state. The bottom line is this. What the governor has done is that he has put this very, I believe, divisive and misleading Opportunity School Districts package together. And it's the same thing that 152 counties voted against on the ballot last November. So I think the problem here is that Republicans are trying to take away local control from parents. They want to create more bureaucracy in our school systems. And more importantly, when you say that these schools are failing and there's no data that backs up that false claim, that lies the problem. So I think this is going to be an ongoing conversation, and I hope that folks are paying really close attention and really read the fine print of this bill.
When I say failing schools, I mean failing schools, because it means that these kids who are put in those schools have statistically almost no chance of going to college. Statistically, most will drop out before they even get a high school degree. And we know that in a global economy, this is something that we saw so much discussed last year in the presidential election, that people without skills will fall behind in this economy and never be able to get ahead. What we're trying to do is make sure that these kids at least have a chance, that their parents can get involved in some way to help them get to the skill level that can put food on the table. That's all we want. We want to give these kids a chance. I do think there's been some efforts in this bill to restore some of the concerns about local control, to make sure that locals are more involved and have more power over how this is played out. I still have some concerns about the bill, about how it's going to work. And I think that's a little bit confusing, or at least it was when it was initially introduced. So I still think there's work to be done, but the purpose is well-intended.
What Brian doesn't want to mention is that the governor went to work after he lost the Opportunity School District's battle. When these education groups came out in full force, the one time that you've seen all of these groups united, he has now brought them to the table, have had some backroom meetings with no one really being present, and he's promised all of these organizations that they're going to have a seat at the table in this quote-unquote advisory committee, right? So what's very disturbing to me, and I'm a little fired up this morning, is that when I see Democrats, and I won't name names because I want to make sure that I don't offend anyone, but when I see the amount of Democrats who voted against their own interests, these are Democrats who represent counties who voted against OSD, Opportunity School Districts, in November. For them to basically say, okay, you know what? We're just going to continue to redefine rock bottom in the Democratic Party of Georgia. We're going to go along to get along with this governor because he sat down and he's promised us some stuff. To me, that's the most disappointing thing here. Now, what's also happening is that this bill has now moved to a what I think is nothing going to be what Republicans do well in the state legislature, and they're going to put it in a conference committee. And what they're going to do when they put it in that conference committee, Dennis, they're going to put back all those bad things that were in the initial referendum, and people are just going to let this happen. So I encourage our listeners to not go to sleep on this issue. And if this bill passes, by the way, it won't go to a referendum. It will become state law. And so folks need to be engaged. Folks need to know what's going on, that this is the same segregated, divisive Opportunity School Districts that people in 152 counties voted against last November.
I think it's fascinating that Theron is a member of the minority party, yet is such a staunch defender of the status quo. And I find it really interesting what Theron said about voting against their own interests. What he just said was Democrats who vote for helping schools that aren't getting good results to do better. And I wonder why that is. And I theorize that it's because Theron doesn't want educated voters because then they might make money and be worried about taxes and become Republicans.
Hey, you know what? The guy that's sitting beside you is a educated voter who's a Democrat, who also went to a public school, who was raised by a single parent. So this whole notion that Republicans want to push, oh my God, we want to help the poor black kids in these failing school districts, it's not going to work. What you need to do is make sure that parents are at the table, Brian. Make sure that you don't take away local control for these hardworking teachers, these hardworking school board members. That's the problem here.
So real quickly, guesses from each of you as to whether this passes this year, because it's a two-year session. If it doesn't make it this year, it just picks up right where it left off.
Senate Democrats don't step up and show some leadership, and they cannot build a coalition with what I believe some few rural senators who actually oppose this bill, I think we can stop it. If those two groups do not get together, then I think it passes.
Brian, is it ready for a vote?
I don't think that Senate Democrats by themselves can stop anything whatsoever because this is a simple majority chamber.
They need rural Republicans.
Yeah, it would have to be a bipartisan coalition. And I just haven't seen a bunch of wringing of hands from Republicans about this bill, which leads me to believe it will pass and will give them a legislative accomplishment they can point to as, hey, we're trying to do something about a system that is leaving too many kids behind.
Another bill that's gotten a lot of attention is the Campus Carry Bill. It is the revised version of the bill the governor vetoed last year, which would allow holders of concealed weapons permits to bring their guns into more places on college campuses. Brian, the governor dropped an interesting hint this week. He said the bill needs more work, but he didn't say it's the same thing, I'm going to veto it. He kind of left the door open here.
You know, last year he wrote a handwritten note to A very specific one about what he wanted in there. And when he drops these breadcrumbs that suggest there's a trail to getting to where you want to go, he needs to step forward and say exactly what he'll sign. And I would suspect, knowing his history and knowing how he operates with the legislature, he's got an open-door policy, a lot of give and take, that he is engaging behind the scenes to say, here's what I can sign. You know, as somebody who was with Governor Deal in the 2010 campaign and his administration and did his reelect, we got tremendous support from Second Amendment groups because he's got such a staunch record on making sure people can have the right to bear arms in Georgia and that we have laws that back that up. So you can really see where his center of gravity is here by saying, I'm willing to negotiate, I'm willing to try to push this forward. He doesn't want to veto a gun rights bill. He does not want to do it.
But he's not running for reelection. There's no danger he'll be primaried.
No, there's no danger of that. But it just shows you where his center of gravity is. His center of gravity is let's lean toward gun rights.
Just because you've had a few minor tweaks to this bill still makes it a bad bill. And let me tell you why. Governor Deal was right to veto this bill last session, and I've commended him time and time again for that. But when you look at 54% of the voters right now oppose allowing guns on college campuses, when you have college presidents, you have professors, you have parents, and you even have student groups who don't want guns on their campuses, you're going against the will of the people. Now, the other thing that's really just baffling to me, Dennis, is that someone needs to educate me on how it will create a safer college atmosphere, a safer college experience for young men and women by giving them the right to be able to carry guns on campus. I'm missing something here. Maybe I'm not as smart as I think I am because Brian think I went to a public school and then I grew up in a poor area of Athens. Someone help me understand that.
Brian, very quickly, in last year's veto message, the governor said the right to bear arms is protected in the U.S. and Georgia constitutions, but that does not rule out restrictions in what he called sensitive places. So just taking a guess here, why do you think that having said that last year, he's taking at least another look this year?
Because he does have a great relationship with the General Assembly, and this is obviously a priority for some of his best allies in the legislature. I think that's what it is. He is trying to make them happy to some degree and use that as capital when he needs something from them. That's a bit how this process works across the country. It's a give and take. And so I do think that's why he's engaging in this. I do think if he had his druthers, it just wouldn't come up. I mean, it puts him in a fairly tough position. He doesn't want to have to veto a gun rights bill again. And there are serious concerns that need to be addressed. There is the issue of what does this do on attracting and retaining highly qualified faculty? What does it mean in a science lab where there are combustible materials that could have much wider spread damage? If they address some of those, I think they may be able to come to a compromise with him.
Turning to local elections, we've got one coming up on April 18th, a special election in the 6th Congressional District, former Congressman Tom Price's old seat. Theron, there are more than one Democratic candidate in this race, but only one is getting serious money, John Ossoff. Question is, are Democrats deliberately anointing a candidate here, and do they have a realistic chance in this district?
Well, we're trying to consolidate a Democratic vote that we know exists in really the portion of the district, which is Cobb County. If you remember, Cobb County turned blue. They voted for Hillary Clinton in the past election. And also, this is a district that Donald Trump only defeated Hillary Clinton by one percentage point. The challenge we have is at a time when you have all these Democrats and you have one gentleman in John Ossoff who's got a lot of money that he's raised and also a lot of money that's been pledged, who's up on the air and who's already being attacked by the Republican Party. I think that he's got to do a really good job of not allowing the Republicans to define him. He's got to run on his strong record as far as being a Democrat. But more importantly, when what Brian is going to point out is that this is still a Republican conservative district. So he's got to figure out a way to not only excite Democrats, he's got to get some moderate college-educated women in that district to vote for him.
How does he do that?
I think he continues to talk about his biographical experience. I think he continues to really push back on this whole assertion that he didn't work on the Hill, that he doesn't have national security experience. I think he's got to talk about jobs, and I think that's something that you're starting to hear a lot from his campaign.
Brian, on the Republican side, the problem is you got lots of candidates with a lot of experience going after each other. One of them is going to make it to a runoff, at least one.
Several dynamics here. One, for John Ossoff, it is mind-boggling to me how much money and how much resources Democrats are pouring into this race. He perhaps will have raised by the end of March $4 million. That's what Democrat officials in Washington are saying. And they certainly are climbing toward that. And they've talked about obscene numbers, like up to 40,000 volunteers. Now, what you're seeing is all of this pent-up rage and anger toward Trump, and they are directing it toward a lost cause. I know John Ossoff from the commercials fancies himself as Han Solo, and he will need the Force. He will need Yoda and Obi-Wan and Princess Leia to really come through for him in their ghost forms for him to even be competitive in this.
You sound like a Star Wars fan as well, Brian.
I may have seen it. The fact is that Trump didn't do well in this district because he underperforms with college-educated whites in many instances, and that was certainly the case in this district. He didn't win this district in the primary last year either. Marco Rubio did. Marco Rubio, by the way, engaged this week on behalf of Judson Hill, who, in full disclosure, I'm consulting with.
And you supported Rubio for president as well.
I did, and we won the district where I live, so victory. You know, on the Republican side, much less money is being spent than on the Democrat side, oddly enough.
Well, at least for now, because
for now, Dan Moody has put in a significant TV buy. He's got an ad that shows Karen Handel portrayed as an elephant wearing pearls. Yeah, Bob Gray seems to be the one who's had some movement in the polls because he got out really early with calls and
really grassroots kind of thing.
And some cable buy on TV. So he's doing some things that are making a difference. And, of course, Judson has got a base in Cobb County, and his path is that he's the only major candidate from Cobb County, whereas there are several significant and serious candidates from North Fulton, Bob Gray, Dan Moody, and Karen Handel.
The one thing to watch here on the Republican side is how do the Donald Trump supported Republicans, many of them are in the race, run in a district where he is probably at a 38 to 40% disapproval rating right now, and he only won by 1%. And at a time when they have that support, how do they sort of attract these voters who clearly don't support what the president is doing, but also are very conservative voters who want to have a Republican in that seat? I think on the Democratic side, we don't really have that problem. I think what Ossoff,
but you have that dilemma because there's the ideological gap.
Well, on the Democratic side, what we've got to do is you can't just be against President Trump. You've got to basically talk about what you're going to be for. And I think that would be the biggest mistake that we can make, to only run a campaign that opposes these crazy actions that President Trump has put in place thus far.
Several things I need to respond to there that Theron said, because I think what he is saying many Democrats believe to be true. Even though Trump only won by one, Johnny Isaacson won the district by more than 20 points. Tom Price won re-election by more than 20 points. That's much more reflective of the district as it is. It is a traditional Republican district, and so it's much less of the populist Republican district that would be heavily in favor of Donald Trump. So there is a bit of a divide there. You have some candidates who are coming out there saying, I'm with Trump all the way. The reason why they're doing that is because they're seeing polling that, despite what Theron thinks, Republican voters, who are the only ones that are going to vote for them, are very happy right now with Donald Trump, particularly with the voting groups most likely to show up on April the 18th, those 65 and older. Trump is very popular with Republicans in that age demographic, and if you're not making 65 and older voters happy, you're not going to be in the runoff.
I think a lot of these voters that are 65 and older, I would assume that many of them are probably not on Twitter, but when they turn on their television set or they listen to this broadcast and they hear about these 6 a.m. tweets that this unhinged, unraveling president is doing every day, I've got to believe that Donald Trump is not doing as well as Brian thinks.
Let's move very quickly to the U.S. Capitol. Theron, I'm going to start with you. The House Republicans came out, the House Republican leadership anyway, came out with its plan to repeal and replace Obamacare. I talked with Atlanta Democratic Congressman David Scott about this. He thinks it's a terrible bill, but Democrats, like Congressman Scott, are in a bit of a tough spot because there are a bunch of Republicans who think this bill doesn't go far enough. So are the Democrats in a place where they have to work with this bill, get what they can from it in order to prevent a bill they like even less from passing?
Finally, the Republicans decided to step up and show some leadership and to put forth a bill that will hopefully address the ongoing issue with people having access to affordable health care. The Democrats have got to be very careful, Dennis, because as you just pointed out, and I think that Congressman Scott has been a leader in Congress, particularly around health care. Some of the points that he brought up is making sure that the older people have access to this health care. I mean, there's an ongoing debate about keeping the pre-existing conditions language in the bill, making sure that people who are young adults staying on their parents' insurance until the age of 26. But what we've got to do as Democrats is that we've got to hold the Republicans accountable. We've got to make sure that they do what they are intended to do, and also that Donald Trump keeps his campaign promise. But we've got to make sure that we put certain sanctions, certain rules, certain requirements in the bill to make sure that these folks, 20 million, by the way, still have access to health care if this bill is passed. And so I think there's going to be a level of compromise at the same time where I think you're going to see a lot of town hall meetings and a lot of conversations with Democratic members of Congress in their district. But ultimately, the onus right now is on the Republicans to lead. They got to get some support amongst themselves. And a lot of members of the House have come out and basically said that they don't think this bill goes far enough and they have extreme concerns about it.
The bill is obviously going to be changed, Brian, sure, as it goes through the process. So it's a little early to count noses on the GOP side. But our House leaders here putting themselves crossways with a lot of the base, especially here in Georgia.
They have to do something. You can't have repeal without replace. And what you're seeing now amongst Republicans in polling is they want it repealed, but they don't want it repealed without a replace.
And they can't agree on what that is.
And we always knew that was going to be the rub. We always knew that was going to be the really tough part because, as John Boehner said recently, Republicans have never agreed on health care. And what he predicted was a repair and rebrand effort, which maybe this is a part of. Tom Price this week said that this was just a start. Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas said last night, slow it down. We need to go a little bit easier.
But
so
they're
this
not
is
slowing
be a longer process.
Running it through committees.
The House side is, which is kind of typical of how the House operates. It's a faster moving, simple majority body, which is different than the Senate, where you need a filibuster-proof majority, which is much, much harder. So I think the House is going to go out there and quickly establish a baseline that the Senate can then work off of. That's kind of how it happened really in 2009, 2010, when we passed Obamacare the first time. The Senate was where things really slowed down.
Will House leaders, House Republican leaders, have to work with Democrats and make some concessions if they want this bill passed, as opposed to the bill that perhaps some of the more conservative members of the GOP caucus in the House would like to see?
I don't think they have to. Yeah, the Freedom Caucus is around 40 members, mm-hmm, maybe. It's going to be really hard to break into that. So you're going to need a handful of House Democrats to switch over. I think they're going to target those who are in districts that were won by Donald Trump. Those districts are getting to be smaller and smaller because the partisan purity is getting to be such in these districts that there's not much of that crossover. But they're still out there, so they'll be targeted. And it might be good politics for them. Somebody like a Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia, where Trump had his second biggest margin in the country after Wyoming, he's somebody who's going to want to play ball. He's going to want to get in there and show that he worked with Trump to come up with a deal that was good for his people, which his people need. They're very, very poor people in West Virginia, probably the poorest state in the country. So he's got some interesting politics. He's one to watch, in my opinion. I think that we have put forward something that's serious, that's credible, and will move the process forward. We need to make sure Georgia's delegation steps to the plate to make sure that we get a fair shake, because we've been getting billions less than other states because we didn't expand Medicaid. That needs to be fixed.
I think the American people really want Congress, Democrats and Republicans and independents to work together. Unfortunately,
Congressman Scott suggested a bipartisan working group apart from the committees.
Absolutely.
Not much chance of that happening.
And let's point something out here. And I know Brian is going to say this. When Obamacare was voted on in the House, yes, we had the majority membership then, and we had to get it done because it was the right thing to do, and the president used up a lot of political capital. But never did you hear what David Scott said from the Republican side. You never, ever heard a Republican, not Secretary Tom Price, any pro-Republicans, and say, hey, Democrats, why don't you work with us to create a bipartisan solution to this? So I want to commend Congressman Scott, and there's a lot of other Democrats who are willing to step up to say, hey, Republicans, let's work together. You got this very divisive president. We don't have to be as divisive as he is in the House and try to do something for the American people. I don't think that's going to happen, but I think that Congressman Scott and others have got to continue to make that offer.
Bipartisanship is something you talk about when you're in the minority in every branch of government, because it's the only hope you have of being relevant.
No, it's the American way, Brian. Okay?
Otherwise, you are just...
I know you guys don't believe in the Statue of Liberty. You want to keep immigrants from legally coming over in this country. You don't want to honor the democracy that this land was founded on.
That has nothing to do with bipartisanship. You know, the minority in the U.S. House is a potted plant that can talk, and that's what it is. I mean, they're just not really relevant to the process. But in the Republicans were obviously not relevant to the process in 2009 and 2010. They were steamrolled. And a certain governor of one of the 50 states was the ranking Republican member of the Energy and Commerce Health Subcommittee in 2009. Who could it be? Nathan Deal can tell you that not one amendment from his side of the panel in the Energy and Commerce Committee was accepted by the Democrats. They were railroaded and steamrolled through that entire process. So what you're getting now is not groundbreaking. It's turnabout.
My grandmother would always say this to me. She said, Theron, two wrongs don't make a right. Brian, I would tell you and all the Republicans that are listening, two wrongs don't make a right. Don't punish us for doing what was right for the American people to get them access to health care.
We will wait and see. Theron Johnson is a Democratic strategist, former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist and former communications director and deputy chief of staff to Governor Nathan Deal. Gentlemen, thanks again. See you soon.
That was fun.
Thank you.